Professor Tonsor, Mr. Fresh, ladies and gentlemen. Although I have no connection with the Tourist Bureau, I'd like to bring you greetings from Arizona, where I'm happy to report we are still able to distinguish between mares, stallions, and geldings, and where the only likely explosions of communal violence might be a border fracas between the Hopis and the Navajos. You can still keep your hat on in the bar in my state, and according to our state law, it is impossible to replieve in a man's horse or gun for debt. It is said that those of us down Arizona way are all armed to the teeth due to our permissive gun laws. But in fact, we simply operate on the assumption that in these times, a prudent man keeps a .45 in the kitchen and a fast horse tethered by the back door. Looking retrospectively at the title of these remarks, it seems to invoke the aura of a caption of a Victorian lithograph. The reference to the florid memory of Byzantium, induced perhaps by Yeats' fascination with its decadence, seeks to suggest an ominous parallel, a rich, ornate, and prestigious society suffering from an atrophy of its political will. This instability underlying the glittering facade have prompted some to raise doubts regarding the ability of contemporary government to cope with a host of problems besieging it. The blunt question has been raised, can government govern? Of course, one can dismiss this question with that ease inculcated by an exposure to the rhetoric of linguistic philosophy. One can point out that if government is defined as an entity that governs, the inquiry reduces to a verbal paradox. I take it, however, that what is meant is, what are the relationships that exist between the activities of government and the objects of governmental action, presumably the enhancement of the well-being of the state? This general query can be restated in terms of a series of deceptively simple questions. What do, in fact, governments do? What ought they to do? What ought they to do that they do not do? And what ought they to do, ought they to stop doing that they presently do? The answers to these inquiries are enormous in scope and lie in their entirety, far beyond the limits of these remarks, but the questions themselves, taken together, underscore a problem which initially at least would seem to be an empirical one. In endeavoring to evaluate the effects of governmental activity upon the common weal, can it be ascertained that this activity, comparatively, is either less efficacious or more restricted in terms of options and reasonable alternatives than previously? Is, in other words, the art of government less effective or less determining or even more detrimental, presumably to be measured against some viable criterion of historical or analytical credibility? It may be necessary, although difficult, to separate a critique of leadership from a critique of the operational imperatives of the governmental-societal relationship. The first consideration is essentially a qualitative one. And the argument that the quality of political leadership in the West is declining is a persuasive one, but the argument turns on an appraisal of the artistic performances of leaders rather than on the dynamics of governmental and societal reciprocity. In the second case, with which I should like to be concerned here, there is involved not the biographic vagaries of statesmen or even the explicit tenabilities of their philosophies, but rather the even more rudimentary notions of the compass of governmental activity as a cultural facet. Given the problematic orientations of our ethos, it would seem indeed that there can be detected an atrophy of the governmental will quite beyond an alleged paralysis of leadership. We are accustomed to being told that, for example, our major cities, especially New York, may be ungovernable, or that our governments are helpless in the discretionary sense to affect change in national expenditures, the welfare culture, the rising momentum of crime, or even in the inexorable drifts of the economy. An era of so-called big government is also characterized, it appears, by a certain executive impotency. Domestic policy, put another way, seems much a victim of irremedial externalities as have been customarily attributed to foreign policy. Putting aside what Bentham once called terrorist language, some credence must be put on the contention that governments seem, in one way or another, less able to cope Or put more formally, that governmental activity has a less decisive influence on the course of social events. Indeed, some have murmured darkly about certain problems as being insoluble. And perhaps this may reflect a surfacing of a neglected wisdom in social thought. But be that as it may, any such judgment hinges on the basic conception of what governments are capable of doing in terms of activity devoted to the enhancement of the national well-being. To entertain such thoughts is to admit that governments are not omnicompetent, that they are innately as well as constitutionally creatures of limited powers. However the preceding statement may appear as a truism, the fact remains that it is historically verifiable that many have supported the contention of governmental omnicompetency and even infallibility, and most who did were not, I point out, advocates of some juggernautine state autocracy, but on the contrary, were enthusiastic defenders of liberalism, spawned in the high tide of liberalism. Their argument was simple and at a certain level cogent. Government and its intrinsic authority was a construction of human ingenuity that quantitatively coalesced the self-interests of individuals. And thus, the sphere of effectual governmental activity was limited only by the wishes, wills, and imaginations of the citizenry. Government could, in theory, accomplish anything thought desirable of accomplishment, save perhaps repealing the physical laws of nature, but even these objective restraints were narrowly defined. Such a viewpoint was intensified by the Geist of the Industrial Technological Revolution and the problematic optimisms of popular democracy. The personalities who directed the activities of government doubtless enjoyed a sincere belief in this credo, but they also were tantalized by the more practical advantages of the doctrine. The grandiose popular expectations regarding the potentialities of governmental activity were widened by overt appeals to public support, based on an increasingly fulsome description of the ameliorative possibilities of governmental initiative. At one stage of the historical process, earlier in this century, such a promise, extended on behalf of effective governmental benevolence, was not altogether unrealistic. The configurations of popular expectation, largely economic and political in a rather restricted sense, were amenable to the artifices of governmental action. Put another way, the problematic objectives were, to a marked degree, realizable within the latent, if unrecognized, capabilities of governmental technique. What went largely unperceived was that at that very juncture, beneath the preoccupations with two chickens in every pot, one man, one vote, serious cultural maladjustments were developing, most of them resultant from the rapid transition to a highly industrialized society with its depletions of individual satisfaction. After the crisis of the Second World War, these maladjustments, principally taking the form of social anxieties, surfaced with a drastic speed and urgency. Racial conflict, moral convulsion, personal anomie and insecurity, even revolutionary ferment, cast in the revival of ideological savagery, rose up to face the practitioners of government. In a way, these anxieties, from a fear of a loss of significant personal liberty to a recognition of the cultural integrity of ethnic minorities, represented a vastly enhanced spectrum of expectations, but also a form of expectation distinctly different from the more mundane, if nonetheless insistent, anticipations connected with economic betterment and a broadened political equality. Viewed in a narrower context, the democratic agonies of the century arose from a turbulent metamorphosis, a yet incomplete passage from a belief in the adequacy of legal and political democracy to the belief in the necessity for the actualization of social democracy. Faced with these unfamiliar and growingly militant expectations, the governmental decision makers responded with their conventional invocation of remedial legislation and executive action. The difficulty arose, however, from the fact that no amount of governmental largesse, either in terms of funds or statutes, appeared to match the expectations or to resolve the social maladjustments that provoked them. Santayana once observed that the true study of politics begins with the psyche. But in another sense, the psyche is not the appropriate realm of government. Government is not a spiritual or psychic instrumentality. It is not even, in my view, an ethical agency in the strict sense. The natural aims of government are corporeal, Government can function only in relationship to the physical, including, of course, restraints upon intolerable behavior. When government enters the regions of thought, it is in trouble. It is either ineffectual or emasculating, but it is never creative. Government, as Michael Oakeshott put it so well, is in the business of attending to arrangements, of hopefully maintaining optimum conditions for the promulgation of other activities. The art of government is not the practice of therapy, except in the limited environmental sense alluded to earlier. Certainly, it cannot, as religion and art may do, penetrate and heal the tempests of the psyche, a faculty in part vulnerable to the abnormalities of the culture. Yet the overblown estimates of governmental remedy persuaded both the governed and those who govern that such was not the case, and that the lengthening wail of the spiritually and culturally dispossessed could be answered by the good intentions of the popular magistracy. The cries for justice from the blacks, the poor, the young, the silent majorities, and so on, were in fact desperate appeals for fulfillment, for a sustaining communal rationale, for a sense of lost surety, in short, for a cessation of the torments of the psyche, individual and social. Governmental succor was a preordained failure, yet failing to appreciate its limitations, government became and becomes the target of angry denunciations and proclamations of its impotency. It has not been government that has failed, but rather the adequacy of our understanding of it. This is not to say, of course, that the practice of government in contemporary America has not been affected by severe inhibiting forces. Permit me to consider two of these. The first involves, at a theoretical level, the reemergence of ideology, not only as a characteristic of the popular mind, but also as the guiding orientation for governmental decision-making. I would like to define ideology in this context as a body of social convictions resting upon a foundation of unchallengeable premises, an espoused and dogmatically held set of first principles from which there can be no legitimate intellectual dissent. One can, of course, either lament the reappearance of ideological inflexibilities or philosophically contest the validity of the ideological posture. But the inherent risks, intellectual and social, that are provoked, in extension, and also the inherent risks, intellectual and social, that are provoked by the doctrinaire set of mind. While I would be sympathetic to these reactions, my intent here is to reflect on what effects, governmentally speaking, follow from the entertainment of ideology as the postulate from which the activity of government flows. Two principal results have occurred. A drastic narrowing of the legitimacy of dispute regarding primary social and political assumptions, and B, a correspondingly severe restriction upon governmental discretion. The first result is more obvious than the second. The entertainment of dogmatic social axioms have very practical consequences in terms of the capabilities of government to react effectively to the national needs, a reaction that may, from time to time, require a benign neglect, to borrow Mr. Moynihan's phrase. It is interesting to note that, campaign oratory aside, the changing of administrations, even from party to party, does not result in major redirections of domestic policy. This is a phenomenon generally understood in foreign affairs, since policy in this area is critically determined by forces beyond the grasp of the decision makers. But now in the domestic realm, there appear to be forces equally inhibiting, and these forces, I submit, are at root the strictures of social ideology. We can no longer get to the roots of our problems because we can no longer frame truly radical questions and pose tentatively the alternatives of policy they imply. Government is obliged, therefore, to deal with national problems on a secondary level or on perhaps even a tertiary level of public discourse. A realism vital to successful government is replaced by a necessity to deal in fantasy, a posture presumably dictated in many cases by a mounting and neurotic need to appease the national vanities of various stripes. Candor is jettisoned in favor of unctuous rhetoric, but also the legislative and executive initiatives are cut to the shape of these ideologically produced and often self-flattering illusions. One can cite examples. No solution to the squalid state of public welfare or to race relations or even to federal fiscal recklessness can be affected because governmental policies in these areas must forego the clarity of rational reflection in exchange for an inherited accumulation of ideological dogma and ill-conceived accessions to unreasonable expectation. Government is trapped in the slim channel of administrative reform or procedural facility, remedies which are ultimately minuscule in their import. To have the policies of the executive and legislative branches so injuriously constricted is one thing, but we now face the even more threatening spectacle of jurisprudential stewardship shifting from its accustomed base to employ its enormous coercive initiative on the basis of the same ideological orientation. This burst of judicial imperialism has further debilitated the judgmental vigor of those aspects of government presumably entrusted with the delineation of policy. The citizen in times past had thought that he enjoyed some personal security from the ideologically motivated excesses of government, that security resting upon the rational dispassion of the courts. He is now shocked to discover that the judiciary appears in the forefront of those forces that militate against the opportunities for first-order re-examinations of the societal and political options. His black-robed friends now appear to him as unsympathetic satraps of some secular orthodoxy. He finds the courts allied, at least in his blunt viewpoint, with those social elements whose claim to special status seems particularly undeserved. The courts have, in fact, supplanted the other branches of government in addressing themselves directly to explicitly social questions. It can be said, of course, that they had to do so, since that operation had been pointedly neglected by the lawmakers and architects of policy. But to argue that Congress or the executive branch was remiss in not themselves confronting the rudimentary social issues does not, by itself, make a case for the advent of the judiciary in this area. The whole problem can be seen in a more limited focus in the current controversy over school busing. The entire idea of school busing rests upon a social predicate, and indeed one rooted more in ideology than in rational evidence or imperative logic. The justification behind school busing is, as is well known, the furtherance of social integration between ethnic groups by the enforcement of arbitrary quantitative racial balances in public schools. In order to sustain this thesis, it is necessary to eliminate from consideration other presumably pertinent factors, among which are nominally accepted educational objectives, the presumed desirability of the maintenance of neighborhood schools, the time and to some extent safety of students, the rights and wishes of parents, the financial limitations of school districts, and the feasibility of enhancing racial comity by enforced quantitative distribution of pupils. In fact, there is no persuasive evidence, so far as I am aware, that insisting upon numerical racial balances in schools is conducive to maximizing congenial and magnanimous social attitudes among people. At the moment, that is merely an assumption. Indeed, we might hazard the admitted guess that whenever government arbitrarily enforces involuntary social relationships, the quality of those relationships deteriorate. But I am prepared to admit that this counter-hypothesis may be as airily speculative as its opposite, save, perhaps, for a certain historical intimation. The not inconsiderable jeopardies involved in school busing, not the least of which may be a mass public opposition that might assume rather strident forms, are summarily dismissed, not even substantially debated, under the interdict of social dogmatism. For a case in point, Judge Marriage in the Richmond School consolidation case expressed the following thesis, and I quote Judge Marriage: schools, the racial composition of which depart significantly from community parity, educators agree, are perceived by parents, teachers, administrators, public officials, pupils, and the community at large as facilities designed and operated for one race or the other. Generally, schools attended under these circumstances by disproportionate numbers of black students are perceived as inferior. Experts generally concur that this has adverse effects not only on black pupils and teachers, but the entire community. A host of altogether reasonable questions follow. What is community parity? Is not the existing racial composition of communities precisely what those who favor busing seek ultimately to change? Is, in fact, the conclusion drawn by Judge Marriage the same as that drawn by parents, teachers, administrators, public officials, pupils, and the community at large? Are schools attended by disproportionate numbers of black students inferior, or are they only perceived as inferior? If the latter, what relevance does this have to the educational advantages of students? Who are the experts and why are they so designated? On what grounds does their judgment rest? On what basis does Judge Marriage argue that the condition he deplores has adverse effects upon the entire community? I confess I cannot answer these questions with any certitude, but I am equally convinced that Judge Marriage cannot either, except by an appeal to the ideological preferences of fashionable liberal sociologists. If such vague, if extravagant declarations carry the sanction of law and determine the social... Yet such vague, if extravagant declarations carry the sanction of law and determine the social policies of governments. Elsewhere in Judge Marriage's rambling decision is that frequent invocation of the phrase viable racial mix. It is obvious enough that an elusive criterion is called forth to clarify the meaning of viable, but it is the tenor of the phrase that I find appalling. It seems to me more suitable language for discussing animal husbandry than for discoursing on the lives of human beings. It is instructive to note that the government presently in power is declared to be opposed to busing to achieve racial balance, or at least its chief executive has so stipulated. It is more than merely a reasonable surmise that a majority of Americans are opposed to it as well. But consider to what exotic lengths it is proposed to go in order to effect a shift in policy. There is some enthusiasm for the passage of a constitutional amendment for the express purpose of curtailing school busing. Must we amend the Constitution in order to change the directions of government policy? Mr. Nixon proposes that the Congress, in some fashion, curb the jurisdiction of the federal courts in this matter. But such a proposal illustrates the temptation to use an otherwise comprehensive and possibly dubious technique with long-ranging implications in the interests of a fairly tightly construed corrective. The fact of the matter is that the machinations of government, to say nothing of the popular will, are finally impotent before the ideologically propelled judicial juggernaut. Must the populace now resort to wide-scale civil disobedience? I would hope not, but the patience of the American people in this anxious and socially intimate matter has, I think, been notable, to say the very least. It is not the blunting of the popular will that disturbs me, but the inability of government in all of its facets to deal with the problem both on an elemental philosophical level and with a tolerable range of options and techniques, unencumbered by an ex cathedra invocation of social ideology. Our priorities are presently being defiantly disturbed. What we ought to do with our schools depends on our best judgments as to what will most improve the educational standards involved, what is best for our children's development as civilized men and women. School arrangements cannot be tangential skirmishes in some omnibus social master plan, resting upon unverified abstractions. If the rigors of school busing can be rationally shown as necessary to the increase of educational quality, so be it. But if it cannot, then we and government must be allowed to exercise judgment in ordering the appropriateness of ends and means. No better source exists for instruction in the significance of the emergence of bureaucracy than Max Weber. But even Weber's analysis falls short in predicting some of the ramifications of bureaucratic growth to be witnessed in the second half of this century. Weber acutely saw the likelihood that bureaucracies within governmental frameworks would in time develop their own internalized value systems and procedural doctrines. What he did not completely foresee was the extent to which these internal goals and values of the bureaucracy could become in opposition to other elements of government. How much these indigenous precepts could be dominated by ideological considerations, and how independent bureaucracies could become from the will of the designated organs of policy formulation. It is a striking phenomenon, the extent to which bureaucracies are now relatively immune from the direction of the executive, the Congress, the parties, and the electorate. This immunity from decisive interference from other governmental sectors is yet another major explanation for the presumed deterioration of the effectiveness of government in enjoying a wide discretionary range in response to the challenges of the times. To a large extent, bureaucracies have become self-perpetuating organs, deeply convinced of their own expertise and superiority, in contrast to what they conclude are the deficiencies of elected officials, their presumed lack of technical competence, their predilection for expedient compromise, and above all, their ideological irregularities. The nominal deliberative channels of government are thought to be, by the bureaucracies, ponderous and untidy, an anachronistic millstone around their necks that they have been delighted in considerable measure to slip. One acknowledged aspect of the rise of so-called big government has been a vast increase in the power of the executive branch. This was attributed to an amplification of the powers of the presidency in the main. With Franklin Roosevelt and his successors, the president became a puissant and semi-independent tribunate of the people. The initiative in policymaking significantly became his, to the diminishment of the prestige of the Congress. Great alarm was evidenced over this trend. The growth of the executive bureaucracy was nervously noted, the presumption being that the rapid expansion of the bureaucracy contributed to presidential power. The bureaucracy was conceived to be the formidable instrument conveying the president's subjective inclinations. By the late 1960s, however, it was apparent that this was an inaccurate view. Two factors were manifest. A, the executive bureaucracy had developed its own internal Weltanschauung, and B, the president was increasingly powerless to interfere with it. The relationships between the president and the bureaucracy ranged from a guarded compatibility to an uneasy truce, to a secret clash of opinion, to a public test of will. The bureaucracy, within the scope of this latter state of affairs, generally winning the decision on points. The bureaucracy was quickly becoming unassailable. Presidents and their administrations could come and go, but the influential molders of bureaucratic philosophy were safely entrenched within the structure. Unlike the British civil servants, these bureaucrats felt no obligation to carry forth the policy directives of their elected chiefs. They felt no mandate to shift philosophical perspective. Quite the contrary. They had their own objectives to pursue, and they retained a zealous conviction of their own rightness and social mission. Paradoxically, the all-powerful American president had become, in part, a captive of his own bureaucracy. This was a perplexing predicament for a president to be in, especially for those brought up with the tradition of more or less unlimited presidential initiative. Presidents found it difficult to cope. They were contending against a foe they found awkward to reach and apply the conventional devices of pressure. An illuminating case is provided by the frustrations of Mr. Nixon in dealing with the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. His introduction to this tournament was provided by the fate of his initial appointee as secretary, Mr. Robert Finch, a political veteran of no small experience and capability, who was almost literally reduced to a nervous breakdown by the subtle and effective intransigence of HEW bureaucrats. Subsequent trials at arms between the president and HEW have been chilling reverses for the presidential will. It has been a sobering lesson for the American president, a governmental officer who, in past, had a perhaps overly expansive estimate of his prerogatives. But it does not bode well for the practice of the art of governing. The reduction of the ability of the president and Congress to impose their policy choices upon the bureaucracy can only lead to a more blatant insensitivity to social realities, to a further enshrinement of slide rule policy imposed upon human beings. This bureaucratic preference for social engineering of the more technologically articulated sort is not difficult to explain in view of the fact that the bureaucracy is increasingly manned by former academics, mostly social scientists, who feel that the only way to deal with the intractability of human nature is to avail themselves of the coercive possibilities of government. The threat of expanding bureaucratic control has been much discussed. But not enough concern has been expressed regarding the detrimental effect of bureaucratic preeminence upon more conventional governmental instrumentalities. This bureaucratic ascendancy is not only present on the level of the federal government, but can be seen even in municipal circumstances. And the restoration of the vitality of local government is a neglected aspect of political reform. While national government ought not to be simply the voice of the general will, its partial freedom from popular whim a necessary condition for its activity. It ought not to be impervious either to the public will or insensitive to it. Its effectiveness vanishes if it cannot have a realistic estimation of what the problems are and if it proffers solutions not on the basis of their potential success, but on the grounds of their identity with the preconceptions of an insular guild of the ideologically faithful. The increasing incapability of the President and Congress to impose their judgments on a quasi-professionalized bureaucracy constitutes a more serious deadlock of democracy than that described some time ago by Professor Burns. These factors that cripple the effectiveness of government, the irrationality of expectation, the reign of ideology, and the ascendancy of the bureaucracy pose drastic difficulties for the national well-being. But these debilities are, in a sense, qualitative. They do not immediately impair the survival potentiality of the society. However, the impotency of government might well involve that which is more elemental. It is a contentious matter, of course, as to what is the basic responsibility of government, its raison d'etre. I cannot here open that awesome question, but I am for myself convinced that this irreducible objective of government is the maintenance of order. I do not ask you to accept this conclusion, but I would ask you to ponder the question of whether the atrophy of governmental potentialities, instrumentally speaking, as we have discussed them, could produce a situation in which government was incapable of guaranteeing nominal domestic order. This republic was instituted, as we all know, to, among other things, ensure domestic tranquility. In one sense, tranquility and order are not the same thing. I could imagine a state of affairs in which order is maintained, but that condition would fall short of tranquility. Order may be essential, as I think it is, but it is also possible that no civilized society can long endure bereft of tranquility. I do not doubt that some variety of order will be maintained if that is construed to mean the physical ability of government to suppress major armed insurrection. But I do not think government fulfills its primary mission thereby, certainly not within the cultural configurations of this nation. Nor do I think, contrary to many of my right-leaning colleagues, that tranquility in our time can be enhanced by a comprehensive contraction of governmental responsibilities. The mobilities of a Darwinian postulated society do not strike me as conducive to tranquility as I understand it. Order is, after all, in one sense at least, a formal term. I can place a row of billiard balls in order. But tranquility is a state of mind. It returns us to Santayana's connection of politics to the human psyche. If government is to introduce tranquility, it must attend to arrangements in such a fashion as to provoke among the citizenry a tranquil condition of mind. The maintenance of order then blends into security, and a security that transcends the physical safety of the person. I think that that sort of security, that prevalence of tranquility, has already been lost, and it cannot be recovered only by the presumed recapture of freedoms acknowledged to have vanished. It requires a new governmental momentum, but one constituted by a delicate equilibrium between realism and humanism. Our diminishing freedom to talk about social first principles is serious, but it is serious not only because it constricts us intellectually and individually, but also because it cripples the ability of government to provide for reasonable human wants, which you may recall was Burke's supposition regarding the function of government. Our problem is not, I think, that contemporary government suffers from being too benevolent, but rather from the fact that it is not benevolent enough. Its thrust for benevolence is wasted upon the artificialities of abstractions and spurious social doctrine, rather than being expended toward the goal of social tranquility. Fear is the major target for contemporary government, a fear both overt and latent, obvious and subtle. Only government well constituted can provide the securities requisite for the recovery of our lost homonoia. It cannot, by express acts, revivify an abandoned sense of community or a regard for primal human values, but it can, it must, provide the security and order that make these undertakings feasible. The tautology remains: to be a government is to govern.
Thank you, Professor Zoll, for your wide-ranging paper.